to order. The first item today is, in fact, the first is Representative Olin. I believe your first bill on the agenda is number 1569.
That's correct.
This bill would, this is one that would be laid over, right?
Yes.
Yes. Representative Olin, do you want to move your bill for
I will move
layover for possible inclusion?
I'll move House 1569 gets laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Representative Olin, thank you. Go ahead and, what we're going to do now, because of the time constraints, we're going to set time limits on these, and this one I don't think will require much time, so we'll set about 4 minutes for a presentation. If there's any opponents, they'll get equal, and then we'll give about 7 minutes to any discussion or amendments or anything afterwards, and then that'll be it. Representative Olin, go ahead.
Okay, well, this bill is being brought by myself on behalf of the Department of Public Safety. What happened in 2005 when a bill was made is that the province or territory of Canada was inadvertently eliminated from this particular part of the statute. And with me today is Jody Oscarson, who can explain better from the Department of Public Safety.
This initiative...
Ms. Oscarson?
Oscarson.
Thank you.
Driver Compliance Program Manager with the Department of Public Safety.
Go ahead, Ms. Oscarson.
Mr. Chair, members, this initiative would give the department legislative authority to continue the practice of recording traffic violations that occur in Canada on the records of Minnesota drivers. When that was taken out of the 171-01 in 2005, we were not able to put those convictions on the records any longer.
Is there any further testimony? Or?
I'd say if you can answer questions, if there are any, that would basically be what the bill does. So.
Okay. Are there any questions on this bill? Representative Westrum?
Well, Mr. Chair, to the author or the witness, is it delivered for a reason, and does it maybe beg the question, is it worth the time and effort to get them from another country? I can't see that this would be a huge issue and could be a very big bureaucratic cost. And
Ms. Oscarson?
Mr. Chair, members, this is... it's necessary as far as continuing not to mask violations, and it is required to put any violations that Minnesota drivers receive in another state. And this is not a state, it's a province, but we should be putting them on so we don't mask. It was an inadvertent error in 2005. We've always had this previously in 171-01.
Mr. Chair, just inadvertent according to who? I mean, how somebody had to have taken this out.
Ms. Osborne.
Mr. Chair, members, I'm not sure how it was taken out. We came across it when we were sued last year, and we had to remove a DWI from a person's record because Canada was left out of the description of state. And so we were successfully sued by a person that had a DWI in Canada and had to remove it from the record. So to correct that error, we wanted to put this initiative forward.
No further questions. Well, this one is for layover. The chair will lay that over for possible inclusion. The next one, Representative Olin, I believe is 1506, and I believe that's also for possible layover.
That's correct, Your Honor, and I'd move the House File 1506 be approved and left for possible layover or possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. This specific bill is a bill that authorizes an innocent person's name to get straightened out through Department of Public Safety records. Again, this is being asked by a bill that I'm sponsoring on behalf of Department of Public Safety. What can now happen, an individual's name appears at the time of an arrest. The guy uses a false name, uses a name of somebody wrong. That name ends up on your on the records and remains part of the record. Well, then, lo and behold, later fingerprints prove he obviously is not the right person on that bill and isn't the right person in the records, and this would allow that name to actually get removed, so the person who was obviously the wrong person is not sitting with his name in it related to a criminal matter that he should not have been related to. And I have with me Julie Letourneau-Blackner from the Department of Public Safety to explain better.
Ms. Letourneau-Lackner?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Julie Letourneau-Lackner from the BCA.
Ms. Blackner, would you explain the...
Yes, basically, Representative Olin has summarized it quite well. This would actually just remove the name from the public record. We currently have a process in which we can flag the name on the public record, but that is still causing individuals problems because the public record is so accessible via the internet. They're still encountering problems when a background check is done on them through the public terminal.
Representative Fulbert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Did you say this was going to be laid over for the data practice, this bill?
It was going to be laid over, and I think it would go to data practices on the
bill. I believe that would be an appropriate place for it to go.
I don't have a problem with the policy, but in reading this, it's not clear where the fingerprint verification would be the fingerprint of the innocent party, and I don't think if you're innocent, if you're able to prove you're innocent, that you should have to give up your fingerprint to the BCA for their records. So I don't know if there's a way to clean up the language that it would allow for that redaction to occur and not specify a fingerprint as being necessary for that to occur. So there's 2 points. It's not clear whose fingerprint clears it up, number one. And number two, if you're innocent, I don't think you should have, if you can prove you're innocent without giving up your fingerprint, I think you should have that option.
Ms. Letourneau-Lackner?
Mr. Chair, Representative Holberg, it would be the innocent party's fingerprints. We would compare them to the fingerprints that are on the criminal history. We do give these people a Tennyson warning as to how these fingerprints will be used. They're not stored in the AFIS system, so they're not searched against anything. And we don't use them for anything other than to verify they're not the subject of the record, because all of our records are based on fingerprints. The only way to determine they're not the subject of the record is through a fingerprint comparison.
And
Representative Olin.
Chair, maybe I can talk to Representative Olin between now and the time the bill gets put together, but I can't believe that the only way to prove you're innocent is by giving up your fingerprint.
Representative Olin.
I fully understand your position. Maybe we can figure out the right wording, because there's got to be some wording that will work to do it, but I understand where you're coming from.
And just possibly, would it be giving up your fingerprint and then somehow getting it back without them keeping it? I don't know. Representative Westrum.
Well, just to that point exactly, Mr. Chair, we're talking about somebody proving their innocence. What about the state or the other party proving somebody's guilt? That's the way it should be. So
yeah.
I'd like to see if we could work that out. That'd be good.
And I agree with both of them. The only problem is this law is sitting right now. We get these fingerprints. We get this guy's name on our woman's name on the record, and all of a sudden it's sitting there, and it should be removed somehow. And I
agree. That's a good outcome we're trying to achieve. Let's see if we can figure it out.
Okay. Nothing else. The chair will lay over that bill for possible inclusion in the data omnibus. Data practices omnibus. Representative Rowland, you're up again. 1225.
Yes. 1225 is a bill that I was requested to sponsor by the Minnesota State Bar Association real estate property section. And I have with me Dean Thompson today, and I will let Dean explain the bill a lot better than I'm going to be able to.
Mr. Thompson? I'm sorry, Representative Olin, you didn't move the bill yet.
Yes, I will move the 1225 be included in the possibly in the omnibus bill.
Mr. Thompson.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you. I'm Dean Thompson, the co-chair of the Legislative Subcommittee of the Minnesota State Bar Section on Construction Law. And The purpose for this bill is that the Minnesota Supreme Court, in the case of Weston versus McWilliams and Associates, attempted to clarify some disparate law on indemnity and contribution actions and the statute of limitations that apply to them in construction cases. In doing so, the court took a certain reading of the statute that allowed direct actions against a defendant to extend up to 12 years, but limited the time to bring contribution and indemnity actions against third-party defendants to 10 years. That means the entity who is the direct defendant may be precluded from bringing a claim against the third parties who actually caused the damage by this 10-year statute of repose. The Supreme Court didn't indicate that that's a good result. It indicated that it was led to that result by the terms of the statute, and I think encouraged the statute to be amended, which is why we're here today. As you can see, what we've suggested is that actions for contribution and indemnity be extended to 14 years to allow the direct defendant to be sued up to 12 years and then give another 2 years to the direct defendant to bring in third parties. I think the section has talked to all other stakeholders in the construction process. I don't believe anybody is adverse to this correction in the statute. It should benefit everyone in the construction chain. That's why they're using for the amendment. Thank you.
Are there any people opposing this bill? Okay. Are there any questions on the bill? Okay. The chair will then lay it over for possible inclusion in the probably the real property bill. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Thompson. And Representative Olin, your Bill 1278.
I will move that House File 1278 be included in, possibly be included in the omnibus bill. Remember for one.
Thank you for leaving that up to the committee, Representative Olin.
Yes.
Representative Olin, do you want to present the bill then? Go ahead.
And this bill is again coming from the Minnesota State Bar Association, and I have with me Kevin Dunleavy from the Bar Association, who would be a much better witness than I will be trying to explain this, so I'll let Kevin do the main part of the explanation.
Mr. Dunleavy?
Mr. Chairman, I'm Kevin Dunleavy. I'm a co-chair of the Legislative Committee of the Real Property Section of the Bar. And we drafted this bill at the request of the Minnesota Sheriff's Association to clarify the law of foreclosure of homesteads with judgments. There was a case called Kip v. Sueno that went to the Court of Appeals in the Supreme Court. And essentially what we're trying to do in order to clarify the process and respond to those cases is make foreclosure of homesteads similar to a mortgage foreclosure by action. So it becomes a judicial process rather than a non-judicial process. And hopefully that way there won't be so many of these cases going to the appeals court. There's about 200 of them a year in Minnesota. And so the trial court would determine the issues of value, marital homestead, joint tenancy, and non-debtor issues rather than having that go up to the Court of Appeals. The debtor would get the money at the time of the sheriff's sale, a $200,000 exemption, so they could go buy another homestead. And that was an issue that wasn't decided by the court. And then finally, the bill clarifies the order of redemptions with judgment creditors, and that's in response to another case called the Nations Bank case.
Is that the end of your testimony?
Yes.
Is there anybody in opposition to this bill? Are there any questions of anybody? Amendments? Okay, then the chair will lay that over. Thank you, Representative Olin.
Thank you, and
bill.
Thank you.
The next bill is Representative Dominguez. Representative Lilly, would you like to move Representative Dominguez's bill and referral to finance?
Yes, sir. I'd be honored.
Thank you. Representative Dominguez, go ahead and present your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'm here on behalf of House File Number 767. Just a quick overview. It appropriates $400,000 to be the Commissioner of Corrections to fund a two-year offenders reentry project. I'm going to turn it over to my testifier, Ray Coles, who's the executive director of the Midwest Challenge, and he will be giving a testify. My other testifier, I don't see her here. Oh, there she is. And we have two more. Thank you. So I'm going to turn it over to them for the testimony, and then we can take questions.
Okay. Go ahead, Representative.
This is
Mr. Cole.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Ray Cole, and I'm the President, CEO of Midwest Challenge. And also with me today is Cheryl Cabot, the Executive Director of the Central Neighborhood Weed and Seed Program, and Rich Deming, who is a recent graduate of our program. And I'd like to thank you for carrying this bill forward, and really appreciate that opportunity to share with you this morning. This afternoon. We have a packet of information that you should have, a blue packet, and I'd like to direct your attention to one piece in there right now that is titled the Midwest Challenge and Partnership Reentry Pilot. There's quite a few bits of information there about not only our program, but about statistics and profile of offenders. But right now, if we look at that, again, that's the Midwest Challenge and Partnership Reentry Pilot. Midwest Challenge has been working with those struggling with addictions and recovery since 1972. In 2001, we entered the offender reentry world by starting a work release program. I want to share with you an experience I had early on that really changed my whole philosophy of reentry. I remember bringing all our guys together, all 24 of them, and I challenged them that statistics tell me that over 70% of you will be back in prison within 3 years. What are you going to do to make sure you're one of the 30% that does not go back? And I was, the room was dead silence, absolutely no response. And I was shocked by that and surprised. Until afterwards, one of the guys pulled me aside and said, Ray, do you really think any of us can change? This is all we've been doing. It's all we know. It's all we've done all our lives. And what I heard in that was the hopelessness. And like I said, it really changed my whole philosophy of programming. From that point on, everything we did carried with it that element of hope. You can change. You can change your life. You can be different. You can start over. And I want just to emphasize that hopelessness and what a big wall that can be for these men and women to break through. If you go about three-quarters of the way down on that page, you will see that in 2005, our recidivism rate for our graduates was 28%, which is a great stat, that only 28% went back to prison. The downside is that our graduation rate was only 56%, a little more than half. One of the obstacles that we hear a lot about, and it's very true, is employment. But I can also tell you in the 6 years we've been doing this that very few men have been sent back to prison because they didn't have a job. But many, many have been sent back because of the reaction to the rejection, to the constant disappointment, the stress and the pressure. So how will this bill make a difference? The Central Partnership Reentry Pilot Project will bring together a more comprehensive support team to work with individual offenders, beginning prior to release on these issues that are key to their needs and therefore more closely tied to the opportunity for their success. It will also provide an individual that will not only be a guide for these men through the process, they will also be an advocate walking by their side through the ups and downs and the rejection and the stress and the pressure. This reentry specialist will also serve as a connection to several other specialists that will serve on the reentry panel. The panel will consist of representatives, which you'll see on your form there, law enforcement, the Department of Corrections, employment, housing, financial, social services, addiction recovery, mental and physical health, education. We'll also have somebody from the community. And then lastly, a support person that the offender will choose that will walk through with them in this process. We believe this bill will serve to raise our graduation rate, lower our recidivism rate, but and also save thousands of taxpayer dollars. But most important, it'll save lives. Now, Mr. Chair, I would respectfully ask that you recognize Vic Deming, who is a recent graduate of our work release program, and would like to share with you a little bit about his experience and his thoughts.
Mr. Deming, could you give a short, you've got about 3 minutes between the other two of you, so if you could.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead.
My name is Rich Deming. I'm a recent graduate.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. It's an honor to be here in front of you. I'm a recent graduate of Midwest Challenge. After spending considerable time in prison, being able to come to a place that is faith-based and clean and comfortable was a blessing for me. Having to not pay any rent until I found employment was another blessing. It would help if there was a staff person who could assist full-time in helping us get jobs. There is another issue that is a strong detriment to people coming out of prison. We don't let landlords and employers discriminate in other ways. It's important to not let them discriminate against ex-felons. It needs to be removed and mandated. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I have one more.
About a minute or so.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. I'll be very brief. My name is Cheryl Cabot. I'm the executive director for the Central Neighborhood Weed and Seed Initiative. Weed and Seed's been in Minnesota now for 11 years, courtesy initially of state-appropriated funds. And I guess that I will just say that one of the reasons that we are pleased to be partners with Midwest Challenge in this is because we have a strong history in Weed and Seed in Minnesota of becoming front runners. Just this past week, we have been recognized as one of 8 sites out of 330 sites nationwide that will be featured as a best practices site. This is because one of the purposes of Weed and Seed is to create initiatives that will sustain any successes that occur during the life of Weed and Seed, and one of our features will be this reentry pilot project. So we feel very strongly about it. We're very grateful to be able to put it forward to you, and thank you for your time.
Thank you. Is there any testimony in opposition to this? Is there any question, amendments, anything, discussion? Okay, then the chair will lay this over for... Oh, no, this one, I'm sorry. This one goes to finance. So Representative Lilly renews his motion to pass and re-refer the bill to finance committee. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Carries. Referred to finance.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative.
Representative Dominguez. Representative Seidman, you're up.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Simon, do you want to move your
and members? If I could ask, since I'm up here for 3 different bills, that a particular one go first because we have a testifier that has some time issues. If you don't mind, House File 1441.
Representative Simon, we will take up 1441 then.
Thank you.
But it's possible later, or just.
I'm stuck.
Great, but doesn't it? Representative Simon, does you? Oh, is this a consent calendar item?
Yes, my motion would be to move it to the consent calendar, but I understand that maybe that can be a tentative motion to see if folks agree that it belongs on the consent calendar. That would be my wish, and maybe I can.
Okay, well, why don't you move that and then we can see?
Okay.
Representative Simon moves that the bill be passed and referred to the consent calendar. Representative Simon, go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This bill should be non-controversial. It already passed out of the Commerce and Labor Committee with about a 60-second hearing. All this does is the State Bar Association bill. It changes old definitions and old terms in statute to new ones. There's no substantive change whatsoever. It's just old terms that aren't used anymore, apparently, and now new terms are being substituted. That's the bill.
Thank you.
Representative Simon. In fact, this was, I can just very quickly speak to this. This was almost put into the revisor's bill. It was so non-controversial. And I don't know if you want your testimony, or it seems very straightforward. Is there any questions or contests for this going on the consent calendar?
Maybe just because the person may...
Since she can't... Okay,
please introduce yourself.
Thank you. My name is Joyce James. I'm co-chair of the Minnesota State Bar Association Probate and Trust Law Legislative Committee. And what you have in front of you is to change obsolete language. Executor of will is not a term that's in the probate code any longer. It's called personal representative. Administrator of the person, again, administrator or guardian is modernized to match the conservatorship and guardianship terms that are in the statute now to guardian of person, conservative of the estate. It's a really housekeeping.
Ms. James, I have one question. Wasn't that changed in law about 25 or 30 years ago, those terms, or 20?
Well, the personal representative of the estate, yes, came in 1975. And
that's what I thought.
That predates this 48A totally, so who knows?
Who knows what happened? Okay.
Right.
Representative Falls, you had a question?
Just to say, Mr. Chair, I certainly support Representative Simon's motion to send this to the consent calendar.
Thank you, Representative Calls. And, is there any testimony against this? I guess Dennis told me there's a tradition here for consent calendar. Then is Representative Simon is okay if Representative Calls has the motion to send it to the consent calendar, since that's what Dennis has said is the tradition here? Okay.
Yes.
All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, carries. Representative Simon, which bill do you want up next?
Why don't we stick with the theme of changes, sort of uniform changes, and if it pleases the committee, go to House File 1063, which is adoption of the Uniform Environmental Covenants Act.
Representative Simon, this one I believe goes to the Committee on Environment and Natural Resources, so do you want to make the motion to pass and re-refer there?
I wasn't sure, Mr. Chair. I thought perhaps it was going right to the floor.
I'm sorry.
I thought it was going to the floor, but if you said otherwise.
Representative Simon, Representative Eakin asked for it. So
that will be my motion.
Thank you, Representative Simon. Representative Simon moves that it be passed and referred to the Committee on Environment and Natural Resources. Go ahead, Representative Simon, with your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House File 1063 would have Minnesota adopt the Uniform Environmental Covenants Act, and others here today can speak more directly and more thoroughly about it and on it than I can, but let me just give you the broad brushstrokes. This is an effort that has been around for many years, a collaborative effort at the national level by the Uniform Commissioners of State Laws, and members who have been here a while know that we frequently see these kinds of bills, and they're product of a lot of work by a lot of people, business, labor, banks, environmentalists, in this one in particular. And we have people in the room here today who are actually part of this national process and can tell you a little bit more about what the bill does. But the basic takeaway, at least for me, Mr. Chair and members, is that this better enables us to make future use of brownfields, enables us as a state to make sure that certain environmental practices that one owner might institute are carried along to other owners along the chain of title. And this will greatly help with redevelopment, and it's important that as many states as possible implement this, so it truly is a uniform state act versus the patchwork of different laws that we have right now. So I've exhausted my expertise on it, Mr. Chair, and I will now...
I have a question. We have an Amendment 173. Is that something you want to get it in the shape that you want it?
It is.
Do you want to move that? Would you first move that?
I will. I move it.
Okay. And do you want to change the...
to House File 1063, I assume.
Yes.
Is the rest of it okay?
It is.
Okay, Representative Simon moves the 173 amendment, and then he moves to amend that, which is allowed by one motion, that it be Representative Simon moves to amend House File 1063 as follows. All in favor of the amendment to the amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Now all in favor of the amendment as amended to the bill to get it in the form he wants, say aye.
Aye.
All. I didn't say, oh, I didn't ask for the nays on the First Amendment. Okay, anybody opposed to the amendment to the amendment? Okay, then that carries. Now we're on the vote to adopt the amendment. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Okay, it's on. Now it's in the shape you wanted in.
And thank you. And Mr. Chair and members, I'd like to really turn it over to an expert, someone who was sort of present at the creation and knows the act inside and out, and I'll let him introduce himself.
Mr. Chair, ladies and gentlemen, my name is Harry Hainsworth. I'm the retired dean and president of William Mitchell College of Law. I am a commissioner of uniform state laws from Minnesota. And I have with me today Michelle Timmons, the revisor of statutes, who is also a commissioner of uniform state laws and was actually on the drafting committee that drafted this act when it was adopted by the commissioners of uniform state laws. And my point really is to tell you that this act is being widely adopted in the country now, and that's one of the purposes of having uniform act, so you can get these kinds of things across the country. And we have worked very closely here with the pollution control authorities and their attorneys, with the real estate section of the bar, and with the environmental law section of the bar. And there are a number of amendments that have been suggested by these individuals and organizations that have been incorporated into 1063, along with the amendment that you just suggested, Representative Simon. And so these have been worked out over a period of about 2 years that we have been working on this bill. So this bill really represents a coming together of all of the various agencies and groups that have expressed a real interest in it. Now, as far as the content is concerned, I would like to ask that you have Mrs. Timmons respond to specific questions or make statements about the content of it.
Ms. Timmons, I think you're familiar to all of us. Would you like to explain it, the content?
Yes, Mr. Chairman and members. I'm Michelle Timmons. I'm the revisor of statutes. One of the jobs that I got when I became the revisor of statutes was to also serve as a commissioner on the National Conference of Commissioners on Uniform State Laws, or NCUSL, which is one of the unwieldiest acronyms I'm aware of, but it's proven to be a very interesting part of my job. And every summer we go over probably 6 or 8 proposed uniform laws. They're read line by line. There's the opportunity to comment on them. Then, in order to prepare for those annual meetings, members serve on drafting committees. And one of the drafting committees that I expressed interest in was this Uniform Environmental Covenants Act. Before I became revisor, I worked for Ramsey County in various capacities in the county attorney's office and as the director of risk management for 3 years, and had quite a bit of experience with environmental problems. So I was very interested in serving on a committee that had the objective of creating a tool to create one of these environmental covenants, which would, in essence, be recorded as a real estate agreement that would either require an ongoing environmental remediation or prohibit perhaps a particular use of a property, such as no residential use because the contamination might be harmful to health in certain parameters. So that's what environmental covenants do. They either require an affirmative ongoing cleanup or remediation, or they might create restrictions on a piece of property. Sometimes they're called a risk-based cleanup, where you're not doing, where maybe it doesn't make economic sense, or even from an environmental standpoint, it doesn't make sense to dig up all the contaminated soil and move it to a different place. Maybe putting blacktop over the land would is the best remedy to solve the environmental problem. So what this act does is it creates a tool to create these kinds of agreements that put restrictions or affirmative obligations on a piece of contaminated property. It doesn't purport to make any judgment about whether or not in any given circumstance these types of agreements are the best thing. That is done by consent of the parties. And so these agreements must be entered into by the owners of the property and the agency, state or federal, and some of these amendments that you have before you make it very clear that in our state, the state agency must approve these before they're entered into. So this act doesn't make any judgments about whether or not one of these agreements should be used to solve the environmental problem. But if the parties concerned, including the state agency involved, makes the decision that they should be used, and they have been used in Minnesota for at least the last 20 to 30 years, then it provides a uniform tool that can, that hopefully, if all the states pass this, there will be a uniform tool across the country that can be utilized. The law makes sure that these agreements are then properly recorded, that they're perpetual unless the parties agree it should be modified or terminated, or there's the ability for a court to step in and make a modification or termination, and at the request of the Pollution Control Agency here in Minnesota, we've also added an sort of intermediate administrative type remedy that is consistent with our existing Administrative Procedures Act and current processes. So, you know, with that, I think that gives you the general reason behind the act and the general parameters.
Ms. Timmons, you just finished about 15 seconds before the end. For the record, I believe Representative Simon is correct, isn't it? The real property section of our association has approved this and has no objection to it. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Okay, thank you. Representative Holberg, did you have a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just get that.
Could I first ask if there's any opponents that would like to testify? Okay, Representative Hover.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Simon, I'm back to the suburban soccer mom talk instead of the legal talk here. Can you force a private property owner to enter into this type of agreement?
Ms. Timmons?
Mr. Chairman, members, Representative Holberg, no. In order to enter into this, there must be consent.
And Mr. Chair, could the PCA say, if you don't enter into an agreement like this, then we're going to pursue other action? Could it be used in that type of a situation?
Ms. Timmons?
Yes. The answer to that would be yes.
Representative Holberg?
Mr. Chair, Representative Simon, or your witnesses, does this provide for any more teeth, if you will, than what the PCA has now.
Ms. Simon. I mean, Ms. Timmons.
I think the answer to that would be no. I believe it's really equivalent in terms of the teeth or the enforcement power. The benefit is more that if the process is uniform across the country, I think it gives PCA the ability to deal with national companies that perhaps are not based in Minnesota, or we certainly have the Department of Defense was a big player in drafting this law. We certainly have Department of Defense properties in Minnesota to deal with. So I think the uniformity is where I believe there is some benefit. A difference, perhaps. Perhaps benefit is a judgment term that perhaps in testifying here with my revisor hat I shouldn't be making, but where there's a difference between what we have today.
Representative Taylor?
I think Gene Hainsworth might have.
Oh.
Just one additional comment is that the person control authority and its attorney, the Attorney General's office, reviewed this very carefully from the point of view of the enforcement powers of the PCA, and they were very satisfied. We made some amendments to accommodate what they wanted to be sure if they had at least the number of powers they currently have.
And Mr. Chair, yes, and
Goldberg, one last question, then we have to
right. My concern is not with the big bad bureaucrats and their ability to impose their will upon property owners. My concern is with the property owners, and if by passing this, if they're losing some rights or remedies that they currently have.
Ms. Timmons?
Mr. Chairman, members, Representative Holberg, I believe the answer to that is no. I don't believe they're losing any rights, and if it helps, some of the observers and direct participants in the drafting committee were counsel from General Electric, major corporations with properties, with property owners of contaminated properties across the country who really felt that this was a good product that balanced the needs.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Ms. Timmons, and I guess our other brain trusts are leaving the room for a second, but in Chisago County, I've been involved in a coalition of landowners and environmentalists that our county just adopted, actually surprisingly unanimously, a comprehensive plan that works with a lot of willing landowners to for some pretty innovative approaches to land use and development. And two of the things that we consider, one is that we actually have a transfer of development rights, transfer of development credits, depending on, I believe that it's development credits in our ordinance program, but actually we have had willing landowners sell their development rights to a developer to then, within the bounds, I think it's school districts is how it's been currently set up, to then cash them in for an actual developable unit, a buildable unit, in the receiving property. We are in the process of looking at establishing a transfer of development credits bank where you'd have a third party holding these credits. The reason why I'm raising all this background information is is just to know whether I've read through the bill two or three times and have not seen anything that would raise concern, but I guess I'm looking to the experts who've gone over this with a fine-tooth comb to see if there's anything in here that would be in conflict or something that I should pay special attention to or the public should, as we're looking to enable in statute transfer development credits banks that have been done in four other states as well.
Ms. Timmons?
Yes, I think the answer to that question would be that there's nothing in here that would prohibit what you're talking about, and in fact, as you were talking, I think there's a benefit arising, or an improvement perhaps arising out of this piece of legislation, because we spent a lot of time talking about who's the holder of this environmental covenant, and the holder is defined so that it can be a third party. The holder does not have to be the pollution control agency. It could be a third party, could be the Sierra Club. It could be a third party nonprofit that's been specifically created to hold a particular interest. So I think that's one of the things that gives actually more flexibility out of this act.
Thank you, Ms. Timmons, and I will speak privately just about the specific provisions in here, but I also just want to underscore what Representative Holbrook was saying, that I think the reason why our coalition really worked, and from some very conservative, strongly libertarian landowners and some self-described tree hudders, was that we really went in saying we're going to work only with willing landowners, and that it's only voluntary, and it was a real education to be a part of that. And I think that we found some real common ground, and it's a pleasure to, and I'm glad to hear that you think that this moves us ahead as well. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Representative Simon, how many states have adopted this NACUSL model?
I will defer to others, Representative Coles.
Mr. Hainsworth?
Yes, my understanding is about 25% of the states have now adopted it, and it's been introduced in about, I don't know how many this year, so I can't tell you how many it will be by the end of this legislative session.
Okay. Matt?
Mr. Chair, currently 14 states have adopted it, along with D.C. and the Virgin Islands.
Thank you.
Virgin Islands, important. Okay. I see no further discussion. Representative Simon renews his motion to pass it and send it to Environmental Committee policy. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, carries. Representative Simon, your last bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
And this one is for layover for possible inclusion.
That's correct. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. House File 1043 is a bill that I think would give us a 21st century tool to combat a 21st century problem. The problem is sex offenders, many of whom use electronic means to perpetrate additional crimes. I don't want to overclaim what this bill would do. To the contrary, I almost want to underclaim. What this bill would do is it would simply provide that among the other bits of information that a sex offender must report to the state, if he must report, would be an email address, an instant messaging account, and like electronic identifiers used for solely for communication, so that may at some point be monitored. The reason I say I don't want to overplay this is I'm not going to pretend that this is going to stop the sort of thing that we all see and hear and read about, nor can I pretend that this will immediately allow law enforcement authorities to monitor the situation. I don't think we're there yet. But if you look at the handouts that I handed out in the various colored sheets of paper, one is like tan, one is yellow, one is blue. The Washington Post article, I think, is particularly instructive from last December 12th. It sets out how the Virginia Attorney General, a Republican, by the way, came up with this idea. As far as I know, he's the first one to do it. And in talking with folks, and I've been in touch with the Department of Corrections, the Department of Public Service, I'm going to be meeting in the coming days and weeks, I hope, with the Eric Lipman's replacement on the sex offender issues with the governor's office. And I'm at liberty to tell you, I asked them before the hearing, that they are interested in working with me on this. But the point here is to give the authorities some novel and potentially useful information so that we can keep track of these folks. I mean, we already have sex offenders provide information about where they are, basically, their name, their address, their telephone number, their license plate number, etc. This is a different kind of information about where they are. It's not so much where they are physically, it's where they are in other ways as well. I do want to address, Mr. Chair, if I could preempt what I think you're going to mention. Chair Mullery had approached me when he saw this bill in and asked me whether or not he was suspicious that maybe there might be some constitutional problems with this, whether this went beyond the permissible scope of what the state may ask of someone. And so Mr. Diebel did some research in conjunction with some others and came to the, I think, the the firm conclusion that there's no constitutional problem with this. And, Mr. Chair, I don't know if you had wanted Mr. Diebel to comment for the record, but I'll leave that to you.
Representative Simon, I was concerned that we'd not have our registration statute challenged, and I don't know if it was on constitutional grounds or otherwise, but it originally was upheld on very narrow grounds, and all the rest of the statute deals with locating the person, and this could be interpreted to be a probation-type requirement, and I'd like to have Mr. Diebel just state for the record that there is no concern with that problem.
Mr. Chair and members, our office did undertake research on this issue at the request of Representative Simon, excuse me, and we're unable to find any case law that prohibited the collection of this type of information. There is a key distinction, as the Chair mentions, that you want to maintain this as a civil regulatory statute so that it doesn't cross over into the realm of criminal law, which would make changes to the law have to be prospective. And that would make changes apply differently to depending on when you entered the predatory offender registration. There's also a distinction as to whether information is made available to the public. And that may be where it gets more dicey when you're sharing information that you collect with the public. That is of less, that's when you get into grounds that could be challenged constitutionally, because you're going into the privacy of the person, and it's not just used for law enforcement purposes of locating the offender. But if the purpose of the legislation is to identify and locate the offender, then it's within the permissible grounds of the statute based on our research.
And Mr. Diebel, so this looks like it can be used to locate the offender, not as a probationary type of thing to figure out what the offender's actually doing on the internet that might be continuing their sex stuff. So this would qualify as the first of those. Not a problem, in other words.
Mr. Chair and members, we could not find a case law that limited the collection of this type of information under predatory offender registration laws, both in Minnesota and nationally. And that's not to say that somebody wouldn't challenge it, but I don't think this is the amount. This incremental step isn't what would tip the registration law over to the point where it's become probationary or almost sanctioned and therefore criminal as opposed to civil regulatory.
Thank you, Mr. Diebel, because I think that's an important explanation.
Yes.
Representative Simon, are you...
Mr. Chair, and I thank Mr. Diebel for doing that. A couple more points that I just wanted to make to the members, and then I'll stand for questions. If you look at the yellow sheet, not the tan sheet, but the yellow sheet, I thought this was extraordinarily innovative of the Virginia Attorney General or the Virginia State Government to do. They have apparently partnered with MySpace.com to prepare to share on some level this information so that MySpace can do some screening. Now, that's not what this bill does. I want to make very clear. But this is a potential predicate so that down the road, and I intend to work in the coming months and years if need be, I guess, with the governor's office and others to see if something like this is feasible. But first, I think it makes sense to make sure that as a matter of policy, we think this is a good idea. Should sex offenders be required to report their email and other electronic communications indicia? And so, as I said, I've been speaking with the Department of Corrections, with the Department of Public Safety, and I hope to meet with former Representative Lippman's successor, too, to discuss this. I'm told that the governor's office is potentially interested in this, and I've been told that I can represent as much to the committee today. I do want to just, on a housekeeping note, let members know that this will not be enacted this year. I would, though, ask for members to move this beyond the committee so that then we can get into the discussion. It'll go to Representative Paymar's committee about how much this will cost, and that really depends on a number of things we could do. If the Department of Public Safety, for example, is required to do some sort of mailing of a new form to all existing registrants, then that would obviously up the cost. And one thing that has been suggested to me by the Department of Public Safety, who, as I said, is interested in this, is that we wait to do the full enactment of this next year when the contemplated Adam Walsh legislation is supposed to come through. There isn't an author yet, but that's being sort of cooked up now. And apparently someone around here will be carrying that next year. And that will necessitate a kind of redo of the form, I'm told, already. So in other words, if we're going to be redoing this form anyway next year, let's hold off and do this next year. However, I would appreciate the committee's indulgence in passing it out of this committee today so that we can get on to the next step, which might not happen for a very long time. But I think it would be an important statement of policy. With that, I guess I'll stand for questions. Well, I just think it's a 21st century tool for a 21st century.
First of all, is there anybody who wants to speak in opposition first? Okay, Representative Hulbert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I don't know if this is for staff or for the author, but so what is the current classification of this information?
What?
The classification of this information. Is this information confidential? Is it non-public, private?
Mr. Gehring.
And Mr. Chair, if the answer is not readily available, maybe I can just state my concerns and Representative Simon can work on it. I mean, I know a lot of information about these sex offenders is posted online. I've never gone to look at it before, and I understand we put quite a bit of this locale type of information. Now, my concern is that, I mean, I don't know if sex offenders are ever rehabilitated, but to post an email address, if, say, somebody actually was rehabilitated and had employment, I mean, if to have an email address of a sex offender posted publicly would invite, I'm guessing, tens of thousands of emails. So just to figure out what the classification is in this section of law, and then...
Representative Hulbert, Mr. Diebel has the answer, I believe.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hulbert, the disclosure of information collected from sex offenders is based on a couple of factors. Primarily, the information on the Internet is solely available for level 3 offenders, and those are offenders that are released from prison that the Department of Corrections has done an assessment on and determined they're the most likely to repeat. And so information statute specifically requires information now be posted on the Internet. So there's only about 100 or so of those actually in the state, and so those are the ones that you can go to the Internet and find information. There's a sliding scale for level 2, which are less likely to reoffend. Excuse me. There are no Internet posting, but there is disclosure of the information to likely victims in their community, including, and then law enforcement has some discretion there. Level 1 offenders, the least likely to reoffend. The information is very tightly held, and if otherwise not permitted here, it's private data on the individual, and so it wouldn't be permissible to disclose the information. Under Representative Simon's proposal, this information would not be distributed to the public. It would be used for law enforcement tracking purposes. And if the person becomes out of compliance with their registration requirements, there's a statute that specifically permits law enforcement to share the necessary information to locate the person. Under those grounds, they may be able to use it if it was relevant, but it's probably not likely to be a useful tool for them to disseminate to the public to identify a person, sending them their email address, more likely their photo, their personal identification and car and license and things of that nature would be used to identify them. But the fallback rule is that the information they retain is private data on the individual.
And Mr. Chair, that's private for level 1 and level 2, but not for level 3, is that correct?
Mr. Diebel.
Mr. Chair, I would prefer to look into that further as to what the scope of the level 3 information is that DOC is required to put on the Internet, and then we can also look to see.
And Mr. Chair, I don't want to take any more time on it, but I want this to work. And I think that if you get to a point where these email addresses are public and they're just flooded with, you know, you're a bad person, emails or whatever, they're just going to hop to another email address. I mean, this should work so that it's helpful to law enforcement. And we get the bad actors, and not that it's just so cumbersome that it breaks down and there's no good purpose for it.
Representative Simon?
I would agree with that, and I'd be happy to work with Representative Hulbert or any member of this committee on improvements. But just to make clear, this is the beginning of the process, not the end. I think once it gets to Representative Paymar's committee, there will be discussion that, frankly, will not end this year about costs, how we can minimize the costs, maybe delay implementation so that these changes that we're hearing will be imminent with this Adam Walsh legislation can be done at the same time. And I do want to work with the governor's office and various agencies to make sure this can work. Like I said, I'm personally intrigued by what Virginia is trying to do here, particularly they're partnering with other private entities. And I know there are a whole host of issues we'll have to look into, and we have to proceed cautiously. I just think it's a really interesting and innovative idea, and one that I'd appreciate if we were on record today as saying that we support at least going forward with. That's all.
And Representative Simon, yes, and I want to make sure we don't drag our registration law down. Representative Emerson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And it's been rather quiet today, so I thought I'd... and I appreciate the way you're operating the committee today. I also appreciate the proposal that Representative Simon has brought forward. I don't think you can do enough when it comes to tracking some of these offenders, and some of the folks that were here a couple of years ago know that I had a couple of proposals that actually passed the House floor, one of which I will not offer this morning, but the other one I will. And I'd like to know if Representative Simon would be interested in accepting an amendment that would read as follows. It would be first at line 1.18, striking the word and then at line 1.21 after the period following internet, actually you change the period to a comma and add the word and then insert the following subpart 8. Shall be required on any motor vehicle for which the individual is the titled owner to purchase and display, quote, sexual predator, close quote, license plates, the form of which to be determined by the Department of Public Safety. Period.
That was posed as a question to me, so I will answer that, Mr. Chair. First of all, I remember when you had that amendment on the floor as a floor amendment, Representative. I'm not sure what I did on that one, to be honest with you. But with all due respect, I think it's an idea whose time will yet come, maybe on a floor amendment. I would not support the amendment to this bill. It may be maybe better to discuss that in a different context. I would just say that one problem I can see with it is the one that Representative Holberg raised about, and I don't think that car would get three blocks without being trashed, basically. And so, and that maybe that's the intention, I don't know. But the point is, and I'm being serious, though, I think that Representative Holberg's point about some identifier where the general public could, you know, perhaps seek to do harm. I mean, I think that's a legitimate concern. And so I guess I would just prefer that the amendment not be put on this bill. While it may be a good idea and it deserves its own full discussion, I appreciate your raising the issue. I would oppose the amendment being attached to this vehicle.
Mr. Chairman,
Representative Ewer.
And forgive me for this, because I could be accused of being a little aggressive on certain issues. This one would be one of them. And I understand that some people find it a little humorous. I do not. I find it probably one of the most serious things that our culture is dealing with today and our children have to face. I think the time is now. I think for the same reasons that you are bringing this bill forward, which I commend you on, I think that we can't do enough. We do it for drunk drivers. We have whiskey plates. Why in God's name we can't put on a plate for a level 3 sex offender what we're dealing with when they're driving through the parking lot at the Ridgedale Mall, when they're driving through the church parking lot near the playground, when they're driving through an elementary school parking lot. I have no idea. And again, Mr. Chairman, I don't know where you were, but I think my colleague actually supported my amendment a couple of years ago, although it may have been because it was amended further to forbid us from including them on designer plates, so you couldn't have sexual predator, proud alumnus of Gustavus Adolphus. But I'm sure... I belabor it. I would ask for a roll call, and I'd like to see it added to this
First
bill.
First of all, Representative Member, you haven't made the motion yet to amend it.
I thought I did right away. I was offering this as an amendment. If you'd like me to word it as moving this amendment, I will move this oral amendment, and I'd appreciate your support.
Representative Simon, I know you oppose it, but do you want to say any more about it?
I would say one thing. I think Representative Holbert put her finger on an additional possible, I'm sure, unintended consequence of this, which is that the predator in question would not refrain from driving the vehicle. He would just drive some other car and basically break the law. And that points out, and this is maybe unorthodox of me to do in a bill that I want passed, but this is in keeping with my theme of under-promising, not over-promising. I fully concede that a very committed sex offender who wants to reoffend will use an email address, probably, other than the one he registers with the state. I understand that. I understand that someone who's really committed to this will do that. But I still think it's a useful tool, particularly if we can partner with these other agencies. So I realize that a smart or resourceful offender will go to almost any lengths to satisfy his desires, I guess. But I think that Representative Holberg's point is well taken, that the actual effect may be that the person just sort of goes around goes around the law.
Representative Hellstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to speak in opposition to the amendment. I did vote against the pink plates on the floor of the House, and I attended a conference this session, and I can't remember the name of it. But anyways, what we were told is that 90% of the victims of sexual assault are related somehow or have some interpersonal relationship with the person, whether it's a coach or a clergy or a family member. And 90% of these sexual assaults go unreported. And as the more and more public reporting that has gone on, the less and less these crimes are committed or are reported. And so what's happening is that family members are going undercover because they don't want to tell people that dad or mom or grandpa or grandma did this. And so what we're seeing is across the country, many laws are being put into place which are causing sexual predators to go underground. And Iowa is a really good example of what's happening now. Since they put a new distance requirement around playgrounds and things of that nature, 90% of their sexual predators have now gone missing and they can't locate them. If you don't know where they're living, it's very difficult to keep track of them. And so I just would caution the members. It does seem like a good idea. But if in fact what we're doing is suppressing the reporting of these crimes, we're actually going against the very thing we're supposed to be trying to prevent. So I would encourage you to vote no.
Representative Olin.
I just got a quick question because I just wanted to get a clarification. Representative Sillers, you're just saying your amendment is actually dealing with this level 3 hammers or whatever.
Right. Representative Chair, Representative Olin, no, it has to do with this section.
No, but just the level 3 offender or all?
No. I didn't go back to check. I'm assuming this is level 3 that this applies to. But whatever, if this is beyond level 3, it should apply to all of them. If you'd like to amend it with level 3, that's fine. And Mr. Chairman, I would just add, I respect those comments by Representative Hellstrom. The only thing that concerns me, as you say, they've all gone missing in Iowa. How do we know they're not here in Minnesota? The stronger the laws we create, the better opportunity that these folks go and find an easier playground for them to achieve their ends. So I just have a little different perspective the way I look at it, but I appreciate the comments.
Okay. Representative Simon opposes that the amendment... Mr. Diebel, do you have it down, or do you?
Sure.
Who has it?
I don't know if you can read it. You want me to read it, Chip? That's how I pass the bar exam.
Representative Emmer, would you read your amendment again and then hand it in so that we have a record?
I will.
No, I took level 3 out because it applies to whatever this is.
It applies.
The amendment, Mr. Chair, is as follows. At 1.18, strike the word and, the new language and. At line 1.21, strike the period after internet, replace it with a comma, and insert the word and. And then insert the following subparagraph 8. Shall be required on any motor vehicle titled in the offender's name to purchase and display, quote, sexual predator license plates, the form of which to be determined by the Department of Public Safety.
Okay, and just an answer to Representative Olin. It does apply to all levels. Okay, then we're ready for the roll call. The clerk will call the roll.
Representative Mullally.
No.
Representative Bigham.
Yes.
Representative Cornish.
Aye.
Representative De La Forest. Representative Emmer.
Yes.
Representative Hestrom.
No.
Representative Holberg.
No.
Representative Johnson. Representative Kalin.
Aye.
Representative Coles.
Aye.
Representative Kranz.
Aye.
Representative Lesh.
No.
Representative Lilly.
No.
Representative Olin.
Aye.
Representative Paymar.
No.
Representative Saylor.
No.
Representative Simon.
No.
Representative Smith. Representative Westrum.
It fails 7-8. Representative Simon renews his motion to send it to Representative Paymar, or to Finance Committee, and they will send it to Representative Paymar's committee. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Carries. Is Mador? Then the meeting is adjourned.
We'll come to order. The first bill on the calendar is Representative Deacon, file number 895.
Yes, I'll move that
to the chair. Representative Johnson has moved recommend that the pass and be referred to Finance Committee. Is that correct, Representative?
That is correct.
Representative Egan, would you go ahead and present your bill?
Wait a minute. I'm not sure that it would go to Finance. I believe that it would go to the General Register. There is no fiscal note to this. It's all policy.
Okay, I'm sorry, Representative Egan, it said the finance, but Representative Johnson changes his motion to move it to the General Register.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Actually, Representative Egan, then it would be we'd lay it over for possible inclusion in our omnibus from here.
Okay.
That
would work out fine.
Just go ahead and present your bill.
Okay, well, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Johnson. This is a very simple bill, and there is, as far as I know, there is no opposition at all to it. The person who brought it to me is the director of the regional facilities in Crookston up in Polk County. There are three counties that currently belong to this, and she's the one that brought it to me, which would allow a county to leave a regional jail facilities, a joint powers agreement, on its own without the agreement of the other counties involved. As the law currently exists, it would require a majority of vote on each of the county boards in order for one county to leave a regional facilities, this would allow them to do so on their own, and that's the gist of the bill. So.
So, Representative Eakin, just to make sure, the person that brought it to you is the head of the joint one, and they're okay with with one leaving.
That is correct.
The person that would be affected, or the group that would be affected, is approving the bill. Okay.
Exactly.
Is there any questions on this? Do you think this would be a consent calendar?
Well, I don't know. Let me ask a question.
Oh, okay.
Maybe I'll answer that. Mr. Chair, Representative Egan, how many of these types of regional jail programs exist?
Representative Egan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Coles. I believe this is the only one at this point that she was telling me it was the only one that would be affected by this at this point, but. And I believe
there's a call.
Mr. Chair, Representative Egan, or maybe staff, is there anything that would prohibit other jurisdictions across the state state from entering into one of these. I understand from what you're saying, Representative Egan, this is the only one that exists today, but can somebody else do this? And I think it goes fine. I'm trying to understand what the intent is.
Representative Egan.
Mr. Chair and Representative Coles, one comment on that. I believe that there is nothing that would preclude any others from doing this. I think Polk and Red Lake and Norman counties were the only ones that took advantage of this. I think it was a change that occurred in 1976, actually, in the law that allowed for these regional facilities to be developed. I think one of the concerns is that maybe this requirement that all have to agree in order for one to leave might be one of those things inhibiting counties from joining into such a regional facilities, entering into such a joint agreement. But the staff had some...
Oh, Representative Olin.
I just had a quick comment in reference to that question. I'm not sure how Olmsted County's correctional system operates, but they got a community corrections which would have several counties. I don't know if it would be similar, but they would have several down there. But
Representative Colt?
Mr. Chair, I guess the only thing that I can think of, and I'm trying to understand the bill here, I guess I'd be a little concerned if somebody came along, they put a regional facility together or some kind of a regional agreement together, and so they backed out and kind of left the other participants hanging high and dry to some extent. I'm just not sure. So I guess I'm not comfortable sending this to the consent calendar now. I'm happy to move it on, either lay it over or move it on to the general register. But I think that's probably not the right place for it to go.
And Representative Smith,
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Representative Egan, a couple questions. From the testimony of that, there's only one instance like this. Can you give me the history, if there is any, on this particular situation? Has any county tried to withdraw from such an agreement and been denied?
Well, I believe, Mr. Chair Representative Smith, I believe Red Lake County was one of those that was considering the possibility of opting out. None has tried to do so at this point, but I think both Norman and Red Lake counties are very small counties, small population. The regional facilities is located in Polk County, which is a much larger county. And what Ms. Mills, the director of the facilities, told me is she felt that it was unfair that a smaller county, which maybe utilized the facilities very little, would have to be contributing to the facilities and paying for it, that it would be an undue burden for them. And so that was her concern, and I think she wanted to give Red Lake County, for instance, the option of leaving if they chose to do so.
Representative Smith.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. One more question. Since the language in the bill refers to since the language in the bill removes some language and replaces it with different language that includes reference to shall be able to withdraw in accordance with the terms of the joint powers agreement, I hate to use the word smacks, but this looks like someone is asking the legislature to modify an existing contract or an existing contractual relationship by which these counties entered into the joint powers agreement. And if that's the case, have you read that contract? And do we know, or do you know, and can you share with us what terms are being altered and who might be burdened by cost if we create a law that abrogates an existing contractual relationship, thus allowing some of the counties to get out? Have you seen the contract, and who gets hurt and who doesn't?
Representative Smith, I think, I'm not sure, but it seems to me like this would allow them to withdraw in accordance with their terms of their joint powers agreement. So it would appear that maybe the joint powers agreement allows this, but that the statute doesn't. I think maybe you read it different, yeah, but I think at least consider that.
And Mr. Chair and Representative Smith, I was going to say the same thing. It really applies to the state law, and turning it over really to the joint powers. and to the counties that are involved. So I have not read the contract, but I believe it does not affect the contracts that are made between the participating counties.
Thank you. Representative Olin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In answer to Representative Smith's question somewhat, Pennington County is just north of these counties. We also had a jail facility, and there was some battling going on when a new facility was built, and I'm just giving you history that's truthful. Actually, if Susan Mills is willing to, from Polk County, to let people out, evidently they're feeling that that's acceptable, because Polk County is the ones that are, I would have expected to be least likely to let anybody out, knowing the political situation over there. Because they are the biggest county, and it's in their county. So.
Is there any other representative calls? Did you have a... Okay, if there's no further questions, Representative Johnson would renew his motion but change it from House File 895. I guess we have the Senate file in our possession, so it would be move Senate File 660.
Wait
a second. Did you feel comfortable to send it to consent or not?
No? I sent it to General okay. Register, but not to consent.
Then we'll lay this over for possible inclusion in our omnibus. Thank you, Representative Eaker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Representative Paymar, do you have your witnesses yet? At least, Representative Palmer, at least you have somebody from the right side of town.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move House File 1823 and have the bill re-referred to the Finance Committee. Mr. Chair, I also have an oral amendment.
Representative Paymar moves the bill and to the Finance Committee, and would you state your oral amendment?
Yes, Mr. Chair, on page 3, line 23, delete the word contractor and insert the words Commissioner of Corrections, and delete the remaining words on that line and the commissioner on line 324. I think that reads right.
So then Representative Paymar would be an independent evaluator selected by the Commissioner of Corrections must conduct an evaluation of the project?
Yes.
Thank you. Then all in favor of the amendment to put in the shape the author wants, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed? Okay, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, I'll be brief. I'd give my testifiers an opportunity to really explain what we're talking about here. But as this committee knows, 6,000 offenders are released from our prisons every year. And 95% of the prisoners who are in our institutions are going to get released, and they're going to be moving back to our neighborhoods and our communities. And the question is how should they move back, and what condition should they be in, and what kind of recidivism rates are we comfortable with in the state of Minnesota? Part of our sentencing is about punishment. Part of our sentencing and incarceration is also about rehabilitation. And part of it also is it's giving offenders who have done their time a chance to effectively reintegrate back into society. And to do that, you need job skills, you need jobs, you need housing, and you need treatment, and you need supervised probation. So in criminology now, the reentry efforts are building throughout the country. I don't think that we've done enough in Minnesota. I know the Department of Corrections and the governor is committed to reentry efforts, and we think we have an idea here with this this demonstration project that could be very helpful to reduce recidivism in the state of Minnesota. So with that, I would turn it over to my testifiers. I don't know if we want to go first. First is Steve Thomas.
Thank you. I'm Steve Thomas, and I'm the chief executive officer of a new social enterprise called The Network, and I'm joined here with my colleague Gary Cunningham, who's one of our founding board members, and I'll turn it over to him in a second. Over a year ago, a team of Minnesota's leading healthcare, housing, workforce development, and medical practitioners came together to address a common objective: achieve much better results in serving a group of high-risk adults. Adults with histories of incarceration, chronic unemployment, and often homelessness. And a disproportionate number of these adults are African American men. And they are likely to be poor, unemployed, socially isolated, and battling mental health conditions and substance abuse. Most of these adults are also costly and routine users of publicly funded services. Our partners, which includes the African American Men Project, the Family Housing Fund, Medica, North Point Health and Wellness Center, the Family Housing Fund, R.S. Eden, Summit Academy, OIC, and Twin Cities Rise, operate well-designed, well-intentioned, and well-managed programs, but a litany of social, financial, and bureaucratic hurdles undermine their potential impact. To complicate matters, the systems and services meant to assist these men are fragmented, uncoordinated, and very expensive. The results: a costly duplication of effort, repeat interventions with poor outcomes, a narrow focus on symptoms rather than root causes, and there's a heavy reliance on institutional or short-term interventions. In response, our partners have crafted a shared vision and a practical strategy. The vision is this: we intend to promote the recovery, resiliency, and prosperity of at-risk adults by creating communities of adults who are doing well. And just as important, our endeavors driven by the belief that these adults have the potential to become somebody again. We believe that by setting high expectations and offering opportunities to meet these expectations, ex-offenders who enroll in the network will be offered the opportunity to become contributing and respectful members of society. These are lofty aspirations, but I assure you our vision is grounded in real-life experience, and we're building our innovation around a set of proven practices and models from around the country. Essentially, the network consists of five core components: housing, short-term work, behavioral health care, primary health care, and community reengagement. We are enrolling our first 50 men as we speak, and this legislation, House File 1823, will enable an innovative project like ours to be launched as a five-year demonstration effort in 2008. Let me just summarize briefly the unique and compelling value of this. First of all, we're embracing, as prescribed in this legislation, we're operating under a performance-based earned income strategy. We only get paid as we enroll eligible men and as we achieve certain results. It's a highly cost-effective alternative to the proven inefficiencies and limited effectiveness of the current systems. And we will rely on existing service providers in order to deliver most of our services and maximize their performance with the resources we would provide. Let me, for a moment here, turn it over to my colleague, Gary Cunningham, and he'll speak about the network from the perspective of his organization.
Mr. Cunningham, welcome to, from a fellow Northsider to St. Paul.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I am honored to be here. I think many of you may know that I am the director of the African American Men Project. I have been for the last 6 years, as well as I am also the CEO of the one of the largest health centers in the state of Minnesota at North Point Health and Wellness in North Minneapolis. And one of the things that we see on a daily basis is men getting out of prison or getting out of incarceration and coming back into the community. And one, they're not immediately able to get a job. And so then they end up being at risk for going back and costing us more money in the system. We see these men that are not connected with their families. We see these men that are not connected to housing. In fact, in Hennepin County, in the single adult homeless shelters, African American men are populating these shelters at an unprecedented rate. When I started working on African-American men some years ago, we started to look at how we could have interventions. And what we found is that we could be successful with some men, but not all men. And we started trying to question why that was and what was that about. When I did an evaluation at Twin Cities Rise, they asked me to come over. And for those of you that don't know what Twin Cities Rise is, it is a job training organization that has done some stellar work in getting both men and women jobs in our community, as well as getting training and getting them in within 18 months to jobs at $26,000, $27,000 a year. But when I went over to Twin Cities Rise and did this evaluation, one of the things that stuck out for me is that there was a huge funnel of men coming in and a small number of them being successful. We also had the same results at our project. And when I looked at the other projects and the other organizations that are partners here, we all had a similar issue. And the question was, how were we going to solve that? Because in part, if we don't begin to solve this issue, the cost to our society of reincarcerating these men over and over again is just getting too high. And so we need to come up with a different approach and a better approach for dealing with that. So what we attempted to do and what we're attempting to do now is working together, taking credibility of these organizations that are partners, and really working together to make a difference for these men. Because we know that if we can't connect these men with work immediately, that if we can't connect these men with their families in a way that they're playing a constructive role as fathers in their lives, in the lives of their children, if we can't connect these men with their community in some constructive way, that they end up at about a 68% chance of going back to jail for a higher crime in the next year. And so this opportunity that we put before you today is really an opportunity to take the culmination of a lot of work that has went on to make a difference for men, and now put it in a way that we could really start seeing some difference. Because we can continue to support women and children, which is a good thing to do, but unless we address this issue of men in these communities, we're going to continue paying on the back end of the system. And I stand ready to answer any questions that you may have.
Are there any questions? Okay, then. Oh, Representative Cole.
Representative Kamer, a couple questions. I'm wondering why, in the definition of high-risk adult, not including people who have already reoffended. I suspect that we could probably classify those individuals under one or the other. I suspect somebody who has already been in the system twice and is now on their way out, probably having some combination of substance abuse, mental illness, chronic unemployment. I guess maybe incarceration means you've been there before, but I guess I'd want to make sure that that group of people were included if this were to go forward.
Representative Cameron?
I'm just conferring with Mr. Thomas here. Those are the kinds of individuals we're looking at. So, wait one sec. Maybe Mr. Thomas.
Mr. Chair? I think I mentioned we've already enrolled seven men, and over the last 3 years, those seven men have been arrested over 110 times. So we're definitely targeting groups who have been multiple users of these facilities.
Representative Coles.
Mr. Chair, and I suspect it's for one of the witnesses. I want to understand, and I may ask these questions again as we mark up the bill, Representative Kamar. So I'm not looking to spend a lot of time on it here, but can you help me understand, if I'm doing the math correctly, we're talking about close to $20,000 per individual that's enrolled annually. What is that money being used for? Because as I look at the metrics the accountability standards, we're talking about maximizing the performance of existing services, coordinating services, and I certainly understand that there's a need to have people, skilled individuals, coordinating this and helping individuals get into the right programs, get access to the right services. But what exactly will you be spending the money on? It seems like a lot of money,
right?
For a worthy cause, right. But help me understand.
Right.
Mr. Thomas.
Chair. Representative, it is two things. First of all, it is a lot of money that you have to compare it to what we're currently spending on this population. And it's, as Gary said, over 60% are going to come back. As I understand it, the first year to incarcerate someone is well over $30,000. But more precisely, our target rate over the 5 years is $12,000 a year. The reason why it's higher in the first 18 months is because we have ramp-up costs and we need to reach a certain volume of men being served to lower it to $12,000. The money will be used for three things. Most of it is for housing assistance. All right, that is probably the most difficult commodity for this population to access, given their record, given their credit history. So almost half of it goes to housing. The next biggest portion goes to what we call our team leader, who's essentially the shepherd for our service team. Somebody has to facilitate the cooperation among these providers. And then the third is a small amount for our jobs enterprise, because we expect that to start earning income, but initially that needs a subsidy. And then there's a small amount in there for a management fee to basically, for overhead.
Mr. Chair, I think you're also getting some matching money.
Yes, I appreciate. Thank you for bringing. We've already raised nearly $700,000 in private funds to begin testing this with 50 men this year. So one of the ways our rate over time will also be lowered is our expectation to continue to attract private investments. And we just found out today that Hennepin County will likely also make a $200,000 investment, again in the testing phase. But so we are attracting other sources of income other than just the state.
Representative Cole.
Mr. Chair, one final question. If you could either, if you have it now, great. If not, if you could provide it to me prior to the time when we mark up Representative Tamar's bill. I guess I'd like an understanding either by dollar amount or by percentage. How much of the money that is funneling through your program is being used for direct services, such as the housing programs, the job programs, and how much is being used for salaries for your employees and other administrative costs, and what's your profit? I'm a Republican, I'm more than happy to see you make a fair and reasonable profit. I don't have an objection to that, but help me understand how your budget is built.
Sure.
And if you can do that now, great. If you want to do it later, that's fine.
Representative Smith.
On that same point of the witnesses, just one question now, and then I'll suggest some other information that I need. You referenced team leaders. Would there be one team leader for 500 people? Or
no.
How many team leaders are you talking
about? Mr. Chair, we're talking about a ratio of about 1 to 20, and we've been basing this on some aggressive care teams from around the country. So that's the... And if I may, again, this is a demonstration. So these are our assumptions going in, and I'd be happy to share. We have a very detailed line item budget that we can break out by a variety of categories.
Chairman of the witnesses, what do you sitting here now envision one of these team leaders to be devoting a full 40-hour plus week time, and what do you envision one of these team leaders' salary to be right now as you sit here?
Mr. Thomas. Sure.
It's a full-time job. And in fact, we just did this today with our initial team leaders. We have to have an on-call schedule for weekends and evenings and nights. And the salary, we're benchmarking this to similar positions at around $35,000.
Mr. Chairman, one other question. I see you do have provisions of the author and maybe even the witnesses for an evaluation to be made and a report back to the legislature by 2013. That seems to be a long way out. Would it be appropriate
annually
to think about when we work this bill over later to have some kind of interim report on a yearly basis? It seems to me if you've got 20 team leaders, one of them could take a few hours to write a note to the legislature to tell us what's going on.
Mr. Thomas?
Mr. Chair, I think Representative Smith, on Subdivision 6, the entity, Star Trek. The entity shall submit annually a report to the Commissioners of Corrections, Human Services, Employment, and Economic Development. That whole section, there is an annual report. I think that what that's referring to in the Subdivision 7 is the five-year demonstration project, the final report.
Mr. Chairman, it's just a thought.
Representative Smith, it is yearly. If you look on line 3.6, they have to make a, unless you would like more in the report than...
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think additional language requiring copies to the leads of the chairs and leads of the...
That's a good idea. We'll do that.
Okay. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Cunningham, have Hennepin County and Ramsey County Community Corrections, have they weighed in? Have you had a chance to talk to them, too, to see what their interest is in participating?
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, I fail to note that I am a Director of Primary Care for Hennepin County, so I also represent Hennepin County in part. We have had discussions with Fred LaFleur, who is the Community Corrections Director at Hennepin County. He is in support of this project, as well as we've had discussions with Dan Engstrom, who is the head of Human Services for Hennepin County, and he's in agreement with this project as well. But we have not talked to anyone, Representative Johnson, from Ramsey County that I'm aware of.
Mr. Chair,
if I may, Representative Johnson, Gary's right. But this Friday we have our first meeting with officials in Ramsey to start introducing them to this concept.
Very good. And just one last question. Do I understand it's an opt-in program then where people need to be cooperative or be a part of the program? They're not forced into it? Is that to understand?
Mr. Chair, Representative voluntary is a relative term, but yes, I mean, you have to accept our offer. That's the way we're looking at it. But we also understand that we want to accommodate some mandated enrollment down the road. But initially, this is a accept an offer. But we've already discovered that it's a very attractive offer.
Good. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Any other questions? Then Representative Primer renews his motion to pass and be referred to finance. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? Carries.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Steiner.
We appreciate you doing
it. You want a shake? There you go.
Hold on. Where do you get them at?
Representative Simon, this bill would be laid over for our, it looks like the vehicle for the data practices bill.
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
Representative Simon, I assume you move your bill, I believe you have an amendment. Do you want, is that your A1 amendment?
Yes.
Do you want to move your amendment?
I will move the amendment.
Okay. All in favor of getting the bill in the shape that the author wants on the A1 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed, no. Okay. Representative Simon, go ahead with your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As you mentioned, Mr. Chair and members, this is the sort of shell or the vehicle for the annual omnibus data practices bill. There will be other provisions obviously added later, but for now, to talk about this particular bill and the technical changes here, I'd just like to turn it over to Lori Beyer-Propensky to describe what's in this particular bill, and then presumably we'd be laying it over so that other things can be added to it later.
Ms. Beyer-Propensky,
Mr. Chair, that was a very good attempt by our propensity. I'll answer to just about anything. As Representative Simon mentioned, this is the basic basis for the omnibus. Each year, it's normally the basis is any temporary classifications that the Commissioner of Admin has approved. In the last calendar year, there were no TCs that were approved, so we offered up some technical changes to form the basis for the omnibus. In Article 1 of the bill, the first section just adds the word designee to the list of who can respond to a data practices request when someone is the subject of data. And what this section does is increase consistency between public data requests and ones from a data subject. It just allows more government employees to be able to respond to a request. So it's a very technical change. Section 2 of the bill adds a provision for the Bureau of Mediation Services. Right now, there is one section that has BMS in it and the Department of Labor and Industry, two separate agencies. So what this bill does is just give them each their own section as they should have. So Section 3 of the bill just removes the Bureau of Mediation Center language from the Labor and Industry section. That will remain the same. So there's no language change. We're just breaking them into two different sections. And then the last article is sections 1 through 29 that just changes the term, which is kind of a mouthful, which is almost as bad as Fire Kropensky, the phrase state agency, political subdivision, or statewide system. In the Data Practices Act, that is a defined term which includes all those, and government entities is the shorthand. So what we do is every place that it's got any of those three things, we just change the term from that to government entity just to improve readability to the extent that this act can be more readable. And those are the only changes. They are very fairly technical, and that's why we offer them as the basis for the omnibus.
And then did you cover the amendments?
Yes, they're all incorporated into the same sections and do the same thing.
Does anybody have any questions on this bill? Okay, then the chair will lay it over for very probable possible inclusion in the omnibus status practices act. Representative Kornstein. Representative Lilly, would you like to move the bill for layover for possible inclusion of the Omnibus Data Practices Act?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I'd be honored to.
Thank you. Representative Kornstein, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. It's really appreciate you hearing this bill and a little history being made tonight. My first bill ever before Public Safety and Civil Justice Committee.
Would you believe in public safety?
So I owe you, you some free. That's what we did our freshman year. That was a class of 2002 thing. Yeah. So, members, this is a straightforward a bill brought to us by both the Metropolitan Council and the Transit Union, and I will pass the mic over to Mr. Shettman, who can explain the bill and its rationale why we're doing it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Hornstein, for taking the bill. What you have before you is a bill that the council is requesting a change to statute 473.129 to classify certain labor relations data relating to the Metropolitan Council as non-public information. In March in 2006, the Met Council received a data practices request for the proposed contract between the Met Council and the Amalgamated Transit Union. This request was made before the contract was voted on by the union and while the parties were in a mediation with the Bureau of Mediation Services. And the council argued in an advisory opinion to the Minnesota Commissioner of Administration that this contract data should be non-public and it should be non-public data until the contract is voted upon and approved by the union membership. The council, and as Representative Hornstein said, the council and the Amalgamated Transit Union, Mr. Ewald, we both support changing the statute in order to classify any or all parts of that management contract to be non-public data. And part of that bill is that the council may only make this classification of data with the written concurrence of the union. And in addition, the council may, at its sole discretion, withdraw from that classification at any time. And if that is the case, nothing in this proposal may be construed to limit or control the release of the described data by the union. So they basically have free rein with that as well. So what we're really doing here is moving forward with a handshake agreement that we will be able to work and negotiate together in a way that we are not having the data practices request occur while we are in the midst of trying to work out a contract. We're afraid that under those scenarios that sometimes rumors get out and it's harder to control the actual information that is being debated. And we would really appreciate your support on this bill. I know that the Department of Administration is going to add a couple thoughts regarding this bill, and also the gentleman from the Newspaper Association has some concerns about this bill as far as keeping some data private. But we would appreciate your support of the bill. And again, we are very happy to be here today with the ATU arm in arm and with the support of Representative Hornstein to move this bill forward. So thank you.
Representative Hornstein, you have from the you're with the ATU?
My name is Jerry Ewald. I'm Vice President of the Amalgamated Transit Union Local 1005. If I could read, our President, Michelle Summers, couldn't be here tonight. She's in Washington, so she asked me to read this. If I could just read this real quick for you. The collective bargaining process can be both difficult and delicate as both management and union attempt to reconcile their competing needs and interests. In most cases, these negotiations between the two parties are best handled between the two parties. And the union's membership's consideration of a proposed agreement should be done within the union. It is important to the union that we have a chance to explain the terms of an agreement before they are debated in the media. Contracts are complex agreements. The media may focus on isolated elements of a proposed agreement without explaining the full context. And that kind of report could give the membership a negative view of the contract before it has been presented to them. So the 1005 supports this bill.
Thank you. Is there any further, Representative Hornstein, or should we take the other?
Mr. Chair, members, that would conclude the testimony in favor of the bill.
Okay. I understand there's some others that want to testify on this bill. Yeah, Jurgen. Okay, Ms. Kruger,
oh, okay.
Breyer.
I guess there are more folks.
Ms. Breyer.
Mr. Chair,
I apologize.
Mr. Chair, members, I'm Rosa Penske, the Director of the Information Policy Analysis Division at the Department of Admin.
Sorry.
At the Department of Administration. Previously, I just mentioned that there were no temporary classifications approved in 2006. There was one approved in 2007 in February. We received an application from the City of Duluth to classify certain labor relations data during mediation with the Bureau of Mediation Services and their unions. That commissioner has the ability to temporary classify data. She also has the ability to take those applications statewide. In February, this application for labor relations mediation data was approved by the commissioner. So right now, the data that is the subject of this bill is covered for all government entities until June 1st of 2009. So next year, we would be presenting you with a bill to make this classification permanent.
So, I'm not quite sure I followed, but are you saying that what they're doing is just coming ahead of what you're going to do permanently next year in a bill for everyone?
Mr. Chair, members, we have an approved temporary classification that the commissioner can approve. That covers both Met Council as well as every other government entity in Minnesota. And our obligation, once the commissioner has approved it, is to send it over that next year to the legislature for you to decide whether or not that classification should stay permanent. So that's what you will be able to do next year.
Mr. Chair, I think I'm tracking your concern a little here, and I think Mr. Shetman can address that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Again, Judge Shetland with the Met Council. I wanted to add to my testimony that the Met Council, the Metropolitan Council, and the HEU, is the only union that bargains with the Metropolitan Council. We are unique, and that's why we are coming just as our own, to get our own unique piece of legislation passed, so that I'm sure as many of the folks around the table remember, we endured a horrible strike about 3 years ago, right about this time, and we are trying to move forward again hand in hand, and since we are the only group that deals with the ATU and they're the only group that we deal with, that we think that this is a good bill and would appreciate your support on it. I know that what the folks from admin are saying is a little bit more broad, and we're here just on behalf of the council and the ATU.
Representative Paul.
Mr. Chair, I just want to make sure that I think I'm following what's going on here, and that was, I think that was one of my questions I had for Representative Paul. Maybe Ms. Breyer. So what you're saying is there is a temporary classification that has already been approved by the commissioner that applies to governmental entities and data related to bargaining before the contract is finalized. That has already been approved. I guess maybe my question is this bill necessary, or does the Met Council already have this protection under the temporary classification that the commissioner has already offered?
Ms. Byer-Kopensky.
Mr. Chair, Representative Coles, that's exactly what I'm saying. At least until June 1st of 2009, unless the legislature does something different, this data is already classified both for Met Council and every other government entity for labor relations data during mediation, which is what they're seeking here.
Mr. Shetland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. And again, the council, we do our contracts in generally in 3-year contract cycles, so we will be in the midst of working out another contract as this could potentially be coming up and expiring. So that's why we're here today, to try to make sure that we have that protection. I think it's a good thing, and we would appreciate that extension.
Representative Cole.
Mr. Chair, I think if we're going to make the extension for the Met Council, at least consider making it for everyone, number one. I'm not sure that I have a position one way or the other. I guess I have one other question, either for Mr. Shetland or for Representative Hornstein. And this is just an ignorance on my part. I understand that the Met Council is currently only negotiating with the ATU, but I guess I'm a little concerned about identifying the ATU here. Why don't we just reference the exclusive representative as opposed to calling out a particular union? I don't know if it's possible for the Teamsters to come in and try to oust the ATU or if we can have a situation like that, even if by ignorance. So if you could help me out.
Mr. Shetland.
Mr. Chair, Representative Coles, I'm going to give this my best shot here. I'm not quite sure. Since the ATU is and the bargaining with the council is unique, if we were to try to have this apply to, say, the Teamsters or AFSCME, they bargain at different times with their different employers, and there would be overlap, and it would create all kinds of problems, the way that I understand, with them as they try to bargain. I'm really not a labor attorney or an expert in this in any way, but I know that when we talked to the folks at the Department of Employee Relations, they understood what we were doing. We went through the process with the governor's office to get this bill here. I know that Dewar had some concerns about being able to do this broadly because of the different agencies and the different governmental units that they bargain with, or that the other groups bargain with. I mean, the council bargains with a number of folks: electricians, pipe fitters, AFSCME, anybody that you can imagine. We're a gigantic organization. We have close to 3,500 employees. But we are just here on behalf of this agreement with the ATU.
Representative Coles.
Mr. Chair, I'll let it go. I know we're going to lay this over. Representative Hornstein, I don't think I have any issue, although I haven't heard from the newspapers yet, so I'll wait past final judgment until I hear from them. But I don't think I have any problem. I mean, it seems to make sense if we're in the middle of contract negotiations. Let's let those work their way out before the data becomes public. But I think we might have a bigger issue here that we should at least think about. If the commissioner's already approved it, if we're going to do it for the Met Council in this situation, maybe we look at moving forward and doing it for everyone.
Representative Coles, just one thing. I hope we get amendments worked out here before we send them on, because when they come back, we're going to be pretty short on time next week. So hopefully we can do that. Somebody is from the Newspaper Association who'd like to... Is there anybody else besides the Newspaper Association who wants to speak on this? Is it Mr. Anthonson?
Yes, it is. Mr. Chairman, members, Mark Anthonson, attorney for the Newspaper Association, the same lonely job I often have coming before this committee. certainly, we're not here to speak against labor unions and public agencies coming hand in hand and arm in arm before you to say they agree on something. I mean, it's a good thing, but we have to ask the question that's at the core of this bill and at the core of this temporary classification as well, which is, whose interests are being advanced by this complete secrecy? Why should the public and the media be completely excluded from being able to monitor the course of these negotiations where the parties who are adversaries have the proposals in hand? From the beginning of our state, when a labor union submitted a proposal to a government agency or the government agency submitted a proposal to the union, the public had some access to that. And they could look at it and they could evaluate it and they could make their own judgments about whether it was a good idea or not. This says we can basically shove it down your throats. We're not going to give you any access until the deal is done. I understand the value of cooperation, but how does that help advance the interests of the public? Because by the time the public knows about this proposal, it's too late to have any input. I respect what Representative Hornstein is attempting to do, and by the way, he was very cordial and helpful in trying to broker some negotiations, which, as you can tell, failed about this bill. But he tried, and we appreciate that. But I think the question's got to be asked, is this good policy? Is the bigger question here, the bigger issue, whether the public should have some little input into what public agencies and their unions are talking about before the deal's done? So that's our concern. Thanks.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Anderson, would the argument hold that the public and the media ought to have the right to know whenever the state has been sued and makes a settlement offer to a party that's involved in a lawsuit with, or vice versa, when an entity that has either been sued or is suing the state makes an offer or a demand?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Cole, I think the answer is yes, because where the line is now drawn, both with litigation and with labor bargaining, and it's been drawn here for a long time, is that the public body may formulate its proposals in secret. You can close meetings now to do that, to decide what you want to propose. And, of course, the union or the private litigant doesn't have a duty of openness. They're not subject to these laws. But once the adversary receives the proposal, why should the public not? That's the question.
Representative Cohen.
Mr. Anthonson, doesn't that run counter to the rules of evidence? Settlement negotiations, as you know, are treated as confidential and are not—they're not admissible as evidence for various reasons. But I guess I don't understand the difference, and I think that that's where I have some trouble with your logic. I mean, we're talking about negotiations. The public and media have the right to the information after the decision has been made. I guess I'm concerned about, I don't know if it was Mr. Shetland or the gentleman from the union talking about these issues being decided in the media, as opposed to some good faith negotiations between the employer and the bargaining.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Coles, I appreciate your concern, but when you talk about these issues being decided in the media, what I think you're really saying is the public is weighing in. It's not just the media. As influential as we like to think we are, often in a very exaggerated fashion, it's issues have traction in the media to the extent they capture the interest of the public. And I think there is a difference between litigation and the rules of evidence in the first place and labor contract bargaining where the public is going to pay, is going to be on the dime. But in my judgment here, this should be played out in the media. This is the kind of thing that should be talked about. Why not?
Well, Mr. Chair, I guess I would hope that the public pays when the state is sued and the state or any public entity decides to settle a lawsuit. And so I think, and I have some concerns about those issues being handled in the press and being public. And I think that, I guess I have some concerns here. I just don't know that I'm on the same page with that.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Coles, and I appreciate that. I mean, if this were a simplistic black and white slam dunk issue, we wouldn't be here. I would leave you with this in terms of your line of questions. It has been done the way that I'm proposing it should continue to be for decades in this state. That's how we've always done it. I appreciate what the author and his proponents are saying, but where's the evidence that this public access for a little bit of the process has harmed the interests of the taxpayers or the public agencies in the state or the unions? I see no evidence that it's caused any harm. This is just another example of how attractive secrecy can be to all of us. And it is.
Representative Lesh.
Thank you. And, you know, Mr. Amundson, I understand and respect, and I spoke with members of the press who are always interested in more openness in what we do. But I think when I, the first subject I heard when Mr. Shetner talked about how we endured a rather difficult strike 3 years ago, and if in fact this thing flares up because it's being negotiated in the press instead of between two parties to a bargaining agreement, that's where we suffer. And I know plenty of folks have different opinions that think that the people around this table, by sheer fact that we're elected officials, that the public have the right to know everything that's in our mail and what have you, but to a certain extent, that doesn't necessarily serve the public either. So I guess I think when two parties are negotiating, there is accountability afterwards in that, you know, people are elected, they appoint Met Council, the members of the union are elected by their membership. Their membership doesn't want to strike. I think that's where the accountability lies. That's one
support. Simon.
Thank you. I'm not familiar with the term that seems to be a defined term here, labor relations data. Is that a specific term of art that's defined somewhere? The stuff you want to get, what is that?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Simon, essentially it means proposals and counterproposals exchanged by parties engaged in collective bargaining.
Representative Simon. Mr. Chair, and nothing more than that? It's just the actual proposal?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Simon, I don't think you can draw a very neat line. A term like labor relations data is intended to be a bit vague at the edges and probably encompasses almost anything that either one of the parties would prepare and then exchange. If it's not exchanged, no matter how it's defined, current law will allow it to be protected from public access. It's once the exchange occurs that the law would now be modified.
So, Mr. Chair, I'm just trying to get at what you would ultimately, what your fantasy scenario would be in terms of what you would be able to get. If two employees in let's say the Met Council,
mm-hmm.
are writing handwritten notes to each other during a negotiation session and said, hey, I'll be the good cop, you be the bad cop on section 42 of the agreement. Is that something you think you ought to get a hold of?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Simon, no, not at all. And I don't think that would be public. Now, what we're trying to get a hold of is when, after the Met Council has closed its meeting to formulate a proposal to give to the ATU, proposing whatever benefits and wage concessions and anything else they might think is a good idea. Once it's transmitted to the adversary party, long-standing practice in this state has provided that is also accessible to the public. The intra-council exchanges by the members would not be within this.
Are there any other questions? Okay, then the chair will lay this bill over for possible inclusion in the data. Omnibus data practices.
Oh,
thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Ewald had one.
Can I just say one thing? Mr. Lesh hit the nail on the head. In 2004, we all remember it was kind of somewhat negotiated in the public. We had Peter Bell on one side and our then President Ron Lloyd on the other. I'll wrap it up real quick. And you got to close?
Yeah. We this is a good bill. Members, thank you, Mr. Chair, for entertaining our proposal. And we'll look forward to the possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Okay, I guess I have to say again that the bill is laid over for possible inclusion in data practices. Brian, where is... I thought...
Hey, I got it.
I'm a minister. All right,
thanks. Thank you.
Okay, has he got a witness here? Is there any witness on Representative Dill's bill? You are? Why don't you? Why don't you come up and state your name, and we can start on that while we're waiting for him. And then when he comes, somebody can move the bill. But first, I don't have your name.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Kathy Lewis with the Division of Lands and Minerals, Department of Natural Resources.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Lewis. And
hi,
Representative Dill.
Well, sorry, Mr. Chair. We have the big bill up down there for game and fish, and there's all our 20 bills, so it just happened to be the way it was. Glad to be here.
Okay, Representative Lesh, would you move Representative Dill's bill?
House Bill 904.
It for possible inclusion in our omnibus bill from this committee on civil law and real estate. Would you like to present your bill then?
Well, I think we needed to move it to environment.
Oh,
finance.
It has to go. Oh, I'm sorry.
I think we have to move it out of here to environment too.
Oh, I was
that first go to finance, Mr. Chair, and then to environment finance, or how does that work?
If it goes to any finance, it goes first to finance full committee.
So my motion would be referred, recommended to pass to finance, further referred to environment natural resources finance.
That would be Representative Lush's motion.
That's what I want.
Okay. Representative Lush, so moves.
Thank you,
Representative Dill, can you start your presentation?
Yes, this is the lands bill, members. And Mr. Chair, all of the provisions, first off, some of the provisions in the bill came from the Department of Natural Resources. And that's normal. Then there are quite a number of provisions that came from members or from counties or from cities. Each and every provision that is in the bill has been approved by the DNR, whether it has to do with land that adjoins public waters, whether it means adjustments of boundaries of state parks, whether it means something a county needs to do a land transfer or a land exchange. All of the provisions in the bill, we have a written document that says that the DNR signs off on these provisions. So there is actually, to my knowledge, nothing controversial in the bill. And I was actually going to ask Mr. Chairman, what provisions specifically were you interested in the bill that we came to your committee? But I do not know.
Representative Bill, or Dill? Representative Bill.
The data.
Representative Dill.
Bill on the Dill, yeah. Ms. Lewis has told me, Mr.
Bill
Chair, it's on page
here.
2 regarding data practices. And that starts on line 2.24, is that correct?
2.23.
2.23, yes. So Ms. Lewis could explain that.
I was going to suggest that maybe Ms. Lewis explain it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. What we're doing in this bill is amending the Landowner Bill of Rights, which is in 84.0274. And that is a law long-standing that governs how the Department of Natural Resources acquires land. And it makes sure that we deal fairly and openly with the landowner. They're willing sellers. We provide them information. It came to our attention this last year that there's a conflict between the Data Practices Act law and our Landowner Bill of Rights law. Under the Landowner Bill of Rights, we provide the landowner the appraised value as we are negotiating with them. Under the Data Practices Act, Minnesota Statute 13.44, it provides that the values of land that the state is acquiring is protected non-public data until certain situations arise, and the one that would apply to the DNR is the parties enter into an agreement. And so we said we want to be able to provide this data to the landowners. We want to resolve the conflict between the two laws. So that's all we're simply doing in the Section 2 of the bill, saying notwithstanding the Data Practices Act, the DNR can continue to be providing this appraisal data to the landowner as we're negotiating to buy the property.
I don't see any questions. I have just a question, and I don't know if I can, if you'll agree to answer it. Dennis, is this, do they ever separate out from that and put it in the omnibus data practices or not? I just wonder, do we normally send them out separate or part of another bill?
Mr. Chairman, that's been done all kinds of ways. You could send it out the way it is. A lot of times this provision will show up in the Senate data practices bill if it doesn't show up in ours. But normally what they do is just take that, this little section. We don't need the whole bill.
Well, that's what I was thinking, Representative Dill, maybe that we could, since we've heard it, we could put a rider on maybe. Is that how we could
correct.
Do it?
Correct. You could make a council can draft up an amendment to Representative Simon's data practices bill. We could slap it on when we do the omnibus bill.
That's what I was thinking, and then we could...
So we just delete this section, Mr. Chairman, of this bill?
You could just leave it in, and we would put it
in
ours, and then
bill.
Eventually it could come out or something like that, and
no,
whatever.
No, I don't think we have any problem with that.
Okay.
We got it traveling.
Mr. Chair, the
only question I have is the comment that the copy of the bill that was in my folder was doesn't show the action of the... Environment Natural Resources Committee. I assume that it's happened out of there, and that's why it's here. Or did you move it here before it was heard in the
Representative Dill.
Well, first, Mr. Chair, we had it in the Game Fish and Forestry Division. That's where we marked up the bill and brought all the pieces together. Then we passed it to the Environment Natural Resources Policy Division, and we passed it out of there to this committee.
And then it goes from here to there, finance.
It goes here to finance, back to Environment Finance.
And
Representative Coles.
Mr. Chair, I guess the only question I have is, you've seen marked up the bill in the Game Fish Division. What I'm looking at appears to be the document, the bill as it was introduced. And if Representative Dill tells me there were no other practices issues or anything like that, I'm fine moving it out of here today. But I'm not sure that you have the right copy of the bill in this folder.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Dill.
As I understand it, the engrossment is on the web, but this is the bill, I guess, it was in your packet as introduced.
Representative Coles, I understand we're going to be having problems like that when we're rushing bills through between committees.
So I guess my question then, Mr. Chair, Representative Dill, the amendments that you referred to, were there any other data practices issues or anything that either you or your witness might think this committee might have some interest in?
Mr. Chair,
Representative Dill.
No, all of the provisions that were added to the bill had strictly to do with a parcel specific. Authorizations that gave the legal descriptions and the reason why, and then, as I said, the department signed off on those provisions. Representative Cornish is also in that committee. I think he could confirm that. He's been in all the committees on this.
Okay, is there any further? Oh, Representative Westcombe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Dill, just in a brief summary, it talks about modifying property, landowner property, bill of rights. Property
under
Bill of Rights. What exactly
is
that?
Ms. Lewis.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the Landowner Bill of Rights was adopted by the legislature in 1980, to direct what the Department of Natural Resources must do with working with landowners to buy their land and what the rights are for the landowners. So there's some basic rights, such as making sure they understand that they have a right to their own attorney. They have a right, the landowner has a right to hire their own appraiser and have appraisal reimbursed to a certain level. The DNR has to be fair and open in dealing with the landowner. We provide the opportunity for them to accompany the appraiser on an inspection of the property. So there's a whole host of rights that we have identified in law that the DNR must follow, and then recognizing the rights the landowner has in and how they're the willing seller. So they can walk away anytime they want to, but it makes sure that we both know our relationships as we are looking through the process.
Representative West,
what are you changing?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, all what we are changing is that we recognized last year in law that there's a conflict between two laws. One is the Data Practices Act, one is the Landowner's Bill of Rights. So since 1980, we have been providing the landowner the appraised value information as we are negotiating with them. We realize that the Data Practices Act says it's protected non-public data at the time we're negotiating, which means we cannot even provide it to the landowner. We reviewed this with the Department of Administration. We looked at the statutes, the canons of statutory construction. We wrestled with that. And we said we needed to bring this to the legislature and get it fixed.
Thank you, Ms. Lewis. Representative,
sure, I'm still asking, what are you doing? What is your fix? Are you making it public, or are you saying no, it's clear it can't be given to the landowner? And let me get to the chase here. My concern, I just recently received an email, and I forwarded Representative Trumbo's district, but it's apparently it's just a scenario up in her area, and the landowner, we're doing some sort of potential land sale. And they were writing because they didn't essentially think there was very fair bargaining, and got the property that was $8,000. The DNR has spent $3,600 on an appraisal and expects them to pay $1,800 of the cost, and they were led to believe it would be about $500 in the beginning. So I don't know for sure if that fits into this scenario or not, but anytime I see that head in the headline, it's something being changed. Tell me what is being changed. Are you sharing that now and it's going to be clear you can share it with the seller, or what are you doing?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I can answer the second part to tell you about the OPASs, but the first issue is what we are doing specifically here is saying we want to share the appraised value information with the landowner for land acquisitions before we make them an offer. We're not changing our practice. What we're doing is saying, notwithstanding the Data Practices Act, which says we're not supposed to do it, we want to be able to continue to do that. So we're making a clarification between a conflict and two laws. The other issue you raised, it concerns OPATs who own 160 acres in northern Beltrami County. They have asked for a land exchange with the state of Minnesota, and they have a piece of property that is surrounded by state property. They have no access to it except over state property. We've given them access by ATV, and we've been negotiating with them on identifying properties to exchange. We identified a 40-acre tract that's on a county road. They said, yes, let's go forward. It came into our St. Paul office, and we sent the appraisers out for bids. And this property is remote with no road access, no public access, and so the appraisers said they don't bid on value. They bid on the basis of what is the cost for them to get there. So they did bid up at $3,600. Under the statutes, the landowner would pay half the cost. The landowner, we sent them a letter. They said that's too much for them. We said we put the exchange on hold. The landowner's not paying any money at this point in time, and we are negotiating with them further on options. But also there's another provision in this bill in the Section 1 that would actually give us a lower valuation process, and the cost would be lower to do it. But marketplace is that the appraisals are high and the cost is to obtain.
Representative Lesher moves his motion to pass it and refer it to finance. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Passes. We are adjourned.
Thank you.